It is 8:30, and we have with us live in the studios once again, John Parrish, co-editor at Eat the Steak. Good morning.
Good morning to you.
All right, plenty to cover, and so let's start out with local. And
sure, why not? Since I don't have anywhere to write about local, and it's in commercial media anyway.
Right, right.
We do have Eat the State, of course.
Yes, which you're coming out with an issue this week, but we'll get to that.
This past week, actually.
Oh, did you?
It's okay. Already out, yeah.
All right, I'm behind the times.
But we will talk about it, yes.
Yes, we will. Aaron Watata, Lieutenant Aaron Watata.
Yes, he got one step closer to the gulag. This week, an Army investigator down at Fort Lewis concluded that, quote, Watata's argument that the war is illegal is a political question and therefore is irrelevant in court. Well, of course, it's not irrelevant in court because if the war is illegal, therefore the order to go deploy to that war is illegal. Quite possibly the investigator's conclusion was itself political. It's so hard to sort all this out. But anyway, that is not a binding recommendation. It's certainly, and it's certainly not a surprise. I mean, you know, it came very quickly, and all available evidence is that the Army is going to try and, bury Lieutenant Watata as quickly as possible and try to depoliticize his trial as much as possible. That investigative recommendation goes next to Watata's commander on Fort Lewis, and then goes the brigade commander, and then goes to the commanding general at Fort Lewis, and who will make the final decision. But the problem is that the charge against Watata of essentially saying mean things about George Bush very well may still stand when formal charges are brought, and therefore the question of Watata's free speech rights and the question of the legality of the war in Iraq, it would really be pretty hard to exclude it. So this may or may not mean anything, but it's certainly an indicator of where the Army wants to go with this.
All right. And moving along, a local judge has made a ruling dealing with pesticides.
Yeah, this one was a little bit more positive. The U.S. District Judge here, a guy named I hope I'm pronouncing this correctly, John Cohanour, Cohanour. Who knows? Anyway, he threw out Environmental Protection Agency rules on 58 different pesticides, finding that the EPA has ignored the Endangered Species Act and basically just decided not to enforce it because they didn't like it. This, of course, because salmon are an endangered species, particularly in the Puget Sound region, as well as really, you know, all of the North Pacific coast from, you know, Northern California on up. And, the federal government would like very much to ignore that because protecting salmon as an endangered species has all kinds of implications, both on the shoreline and in freshwater streams and rivers. But the interesting part of the judge's findings is that the EPA has been doing this for a decade, so it extends all the way back into the Clinton administration, and you know, people forget that the Clinton administration was not particularly good on the environment either. They did do some positive things, and it was certainly better than George W., but there were a lot of ways in which the various federal agencies under Clinton, the Interior and the EPA and so forth were not good, and that of course has just accelerated in the last 5.5 years. So that was a very positive ruling. The quote in the ruling that was most telling was quote, the administrative record is striking in its total lack of any evidence of technical or scientific support for policy positions eventually adopted, which, I'm kind of waiting for the bumper sticker, and maybe somebody out there can produce some of them saying, I'm pro-science and I vote.
All right, let's jump to national. Not exactly the best week for Frank Murkowski.
No, the governor of Alaska, Republican, who is very much in the pocket of the oil industry, very pro-development, talked in this program about the Juneau Road that he had hoped to carve into the side of a fjord cliff, essentially, in pristine wilderness area between Juneau and Skagway. He's also been pushing a natural gas pipeline through Canada to the lower 40. He got hammered in a Republican primary this past week. In a three-way race, he got only 19% of the vote. Those were issues. His arrogance was frequently cited. His appointment of his own daughter to an open U.S. Senate seat in 2003. Lisa Murkowski is still there. And as the junior senator, Ted Stevens, is imitating her mentor whenever possible. And also, he was hurt in these recent weeks because of pretty persistent allegations that he has been looking the other way and having state agencies look the other way rather than inspect BP's pipelines, especially their pipelines around Prudhoe Bay. And, you know, who knows if the leaks that have been happening in those pipelines pretty consistently for at least a decade have been looked at by state inspectors. You might not now have a massive shutdown of the oil fields costing Alaska huge financial revenues and of course, posing an environmental danger to the tundra as well. So he is out. And particularly the interesting thing about this at a national level is, oddly enough, you have an incumbent who is ousted in a primary by an intra-party challenger, and you know, because of his own record and citations of things like arrogance, and the DC punditry is not saying things like the extremists are taking over the party, and Murkowski, even though there has been an independent governor in Alaska fairly recently, Jay Hammond, Murkowski is not running an independent bid for election in November. So I'm kind of wondering what the difference is between Alaska and Connecticut.
All right. Moving along, George Allen, somebody whose name was put on the list for potential presidential
candidate. Yeah. I think he's kind of done some damage to his presidential aspirations. A senator from Virginia who in the past has been criticized, although it hasn't been widely publicized outside Virginia itself, for keeping a Confederate flag in his office for years, for a number of other racially insensitive, shall we say, comments that he has made in the past. He outdid himself this past week at a rally in southwest Virginia running for re-election against James Webb, the former Reagan administration Secretary of the Navy, who's now running as a Democrat, fairly moderate Democrat, but opposed to the war. And a Webb volunteer was in the audience, a young man who grew up in the U.S. but is of South Asian descent. And basically the only non-white in the audience, and someone who is familiar to Allen because he's been trailing Allen around his various campaign appearances. And Allen points him out and, among other things, calls him a macaca, which is a monkey, and tells him to, you know, what was the exact quote? It was something like, it wasn't go home, but it was something like that. It was, welcome to America. That was the deal. And this is fairly egregious. It's certainly lost him what little possibility he had of getting, black and Latino votes in the state of Virginia. And it's given James Webb tremendous traction. Now, this comes at almost exactly the same time that there have been a couple of other fairly high profile instances of Republican office holders saying stupid things regarding to race, particularly a candidate in Florida for the congressional seat formerly held by your hero and mine, Catherine Harris, who suggested that African Americans were inherently incapable of swimming. So it's just not been a good week for how Republicans are received on race issues.
Hmm. All right. The Financial Times came out with it actually comes out with a lot of good reporting.
Yeah, it's funny how you have to go to the British press sometimes to get good reporting on what's happening in our country. That happened again this week. If you remember the Dubai port scandal that was huge news a few months ago, and you know, Democrats piled on and eventually Republicans piled on as well, and the White House was forced to compromise. Well, the Republicans have been piling off, and it turns out that the legislation that was introduced in both houses of Congress to reform the agency that had been charged with reviewing the Dubai port sale, which is a multi-agency panel led by the Treasury Department called the Committee for Foreign Investments in the United States. The congressional legislation was supposed to toughen that up, mandate a period in which sales would be investigated and Congress would be notified, etc. Well, apparently those provisions are being gutted by the House Republican leadership, so that the two options on the plate right now are for Congress to either A, not pass the law at all and do nothing, or B, pass the law and do nothing. So it kind of shows you once again where, when it comes to the question of national security versus economic interests, where the leadership of Congress and, for that matter, where the White House go. To some extent, I think the Dubai port scandal was a bum rap, but certainly the question in general of foreign investment and parts of the United States infrastructure that are important to national security should receive more attention. And obviously, at this point, it's not going to.
All right. Well, speaking of economic interests, we're looking at a year anniversary for Katrina, and it looks like there's a report that's come out indicating that certain economic interests benefited greatly.
Yeah, we're gonna hear a lot about Katrina in the next week. The anniversary of it is coming up on Tuesday, I believe. A Democratic report that was released in the House of Representatives showed that 70% of federal contracts for reconstruction after Katrina were no-bid contracts. And now, you heard the rationale, well, some of them had to be no-bid because they had to mobilize very quickly, immediately in the days after the disaster, and they're just, there wasn't time to go through the normal contract bidding process. Well, it didn't quite work out that way. You see, there were, in fact, 51% of the contracts that were issued in September of 2005, which was, the 4 weeks after the hurricane struck, were no-bid contracts. In October, it went up to 93%, which doesn't suggest, frantic hurry and we don't have any other options. What it suggests is that Republicans were sorting through all the possible corporate donors that they could give contracts to and finally decided who would get what. So it's a pretty damaging report. The flip side of that is that the Republicans had an interesting report this week also, or at least the Senate Budget Committee, which is obviously Republican-controlled. They had been estimating the costs for the development of major new weapon systems for the United States military that have been introduced since 9/11. Now, these are weapon systems that have nothing to do whatsoever with the global war on terror. There are things like, fighting the old Soviet Union, or things that can accommodate new nuclear weapons, which not the bunker busters they're talking about with Iran, but the really big ones. Costs for those weapon systems have doubled since 9/11, which is a little bit more than the rate of inflation. So if you want to talk about profiteering, it's going on at home and it's going on abroad. What a remarkable coincidence.
All right. Well, and clearly with what's going on in the Middle East with the U.S. involvement there, recruiters have their work cut out for them, and it looks like via AP this week that recruiters are being busy in another way as well.
Yeah, we had the Marines calling up their reserves this week. I'll talk about that a little bit more when we get to Iraq developments this week, because the military services are so short-staffed right now. They're having a hard time with new recruits, and this is not going to help. A report from Associated Press this week that more than 100 young women who expressed interest in joining the military in the past year were preyed upon sexually by their recruiters. Now, this is, about 95 more than had been known publicly before. If it was, 100, I mean, there were really only a handful of cases that had been made public up to this point. Women were raped on recruiting office couches. They were assaulted in government cars. They were groped en route to entrance exams. at least 35 Army recruiters, 18 Marine Corps recruiters, 18 Navy recruiters, and 12 Air Force recruiters were disciplined in the past year for sexual misconduct or other inappropriate behavior with potential recruiters in 2005. And that was obtained under the Freedom of Information Act. This is not something that the services voluntarily offered up for public consumption. By way of contrast, if you're wondering how many recruiters that is, the Army, for example, has 8,000 recruiters nationally. So it's about a 1 in 200 ratio. In other words, of every 200 recruiters in the country, one of them was disciplined within, in the calendar year 2005 for sexual misconduct or other similar types of violations, which is just a staggeringly large percentage when you think about it. And interestingly enough, the AP also found that some of this, at least, it's a lot more prevalent in the wake of Iraq, apparently, but some of this has been going on for a while. The Army, for example, has had 722 different recruiters accused of rape and sexual misconduct since 1996, in the last decade, that is. Only a handful of those, again, were previously known publicly. So, once again, recruitment in the military seems to have a serious institutional problem, and this is one that, obviously, in a somewhat different way than we're used to thinking of it, can destroy young recruits' lives.
All right.
Oh, and it wasn't entirely women that were preyed upon. There were some cases also of young men being molested, too.
Richard Armitage, a name that became somewhat known during Iran-Contra.
Yeah, and as with several other veterans of that scandal, has been put in a position of authority by the Bush administration. He was the Deputy Secretary of State during the first term. This is also an Associated Press report that it was Richard Armitage who, in June 2003, met with Washington Post editor Bob Woodward for the book he was working on, and leaked the name of Valerie Plame Wilson. So we may actually finally know the identity of the Bush administration official who, along with Scooter Libby and Karl Rove and Dick Cheney, was trying to spread the word on Valerie Plame Wilson. And I'll talk about her a little bit more when we get to Iran, but that was an interesting report, certainly.
All right, and then finally, the Labor Department has come out with some estimates.
Well, no, it's not the Labor Department that
has.
It's the Center for Economic and Policy Research, which is a nonpartisan think tank. They did a study of the Labor Department, and what they have found is that under the Bush administration, the Labor Department is, quote, significantly underestimating, end quote, the number of poor, the number of uninsured, and the number of non-employed adults in the United States. Some of the numbers on those, and of course, all of that is important because it controls the amount of funding that goes into programs, the amount of money that's remitted to states for their programs, et cetera. They're pretty serious undercounts. For example, the Labor Department is missing 2.5 million non-working adults. That's something like 1.7% that you can add to any estimate of unemployment that you happen to see issued by the government. The biggest demographic in which the Labor Department seems to be missing the non-employed adults is African-American men, surprisingly enough. We also have poverty underestimated by some 600,000 people in the United States who are living in poverty that the Labor Department isn't counting, and the number of blacks and Latinos seem to be overrepresented in that statistic, and uninsured, that is people who don't have health insurance in this country, also being undercounted by some 350,000. So, once again, the Bush administration playing fast and loose with the numbers.
All right. Well, let's jump over to international and Iraq.
Yeah, a lot going on this week. U.S. Marines, as I mentioned, calling up their reserves. It's essentially a backdoor draft, although what they're calling it is an involuntary call-up. Same difference, essentially. The presidential authorization, incidentally, that ordered for that is indefinite. Actually, it's not indefinite. It specifies that it is until the end of the global war on terror, which is to say that it's indefinite. Also this week, we have British soldiers doing something that has never been done before in the war in Iraq, but which may happen more in the future. They abandoned a major base in southern Iraq this week. The Mahdi army, which is the army of Muqtada al-Sadr that has been battling the British in southern Iraq for the last year at least, is claiming victory on that one, and there were celebrations in the street where this base happened. But the British say, no, what we're doing is we're redeploying to the border between Iraq and Iran to try and prevent smuggling of arms into Iraq. Of course, putting soldiers on the border with Iran may serve another purpose as well, and we'll get to that when we talk about Iran. But that's certainly a development. Also, an economic estimate out this week that Iraq inflation has risen in the past year from 30% a year to 70% a year. That is something that cost a dollar last year, costs $1.70 this year. And at the same time, wages for those relative handful of Iraqis who actually have employment, wages have been stagnant. So the privatization drive to lure foreign investors into Iraq has been something of a spectacular failure in terms of its impact on the average Iraqi. Of course, we're getting other people who are getting rich, and among those, an Army Reserve officer, Lieutenant Colonel Bruce Hopfengartner, who pled guilty this week to steering some $80 million in Iraq reconstruction monies to Philip Bloom, a private businessman who has interests in Iraq and Romania, and who pled guilty in April to charges from the similar scandal. This is in the days of the Coalition Provisional Authority, to whom Lieutenant Colonel Hopfengartner was an advisor. He was formerly a police chief in California, incidentally. The good lieutenant colonel received in exchange for steering all those contracts money, plane tickets, jewelry, alcohol, cigars, and sexual favors from women provided by Bloom, probably from Romania, in Bloom's villa in Baghdad and elsewhere. It must be a good life for those who can afford it. The other item around that is that the Bloom faces up to 20 years in prison and a $500,000 fine, but it seems fairly likely that he will not get anything near that.
All right, and finally, there's some polls out this week.
Oh, yes, a couple of interesting ones. The CNN poll shows higher opposition to the war in Iraq than at any previous time since the invasion. 61% of Americans now opposed to the war, and only 35% in favor. Both of those, for that particular poll anyway, are new highs and lows, respectively. And a CBS poll, also taken this week, shows that only 9% of Americans think that Iraq has decrease the risk of terrorism and terrorist attacks against the United States.
All right, let's move on to Iran.
Yeah, in case you think that the failures in Iraq are deterring the White House, think again. They are pushing very steadily toward war. We saw a number of signs of that this week. Iran, of course, rejecting a UN Security Council ultimatum to stop the uranium enrichment by August 31st. So we're going to see a lot of hot air about that in the next week, because the UN Security Council will not pursue sanctions. In fact, Russia just announced this morning that they're going to oppose sanctions against Iran. At the same time, we have the head of the House Intelligence Committee, Peter Hoekstra, releasing his own report rather than the National Intelligence Estimate that was requested by the Senate, releasing his own report called Recognizing Iran as a Strategic Threat, an Intelligence Challenge for the United States, basically a call to the United States to take military action against Iran. And if you can remember, the same kind of thing was done a little bit less directly in the run-up to Iraq, where the Bush administration cooked the national intelligence estimate. Now they're bypassing the intelligence agencies entirely and the House Intelligence Committee partisan. Remember, this is the same guy who, along with Rick Santorum a couple of months ago, claimed that Gulf War era munitions represented the WMDs that had in fact been found in Iraq. So this guy's a bit of a partisan, shall we say, but he is framing the debate right now, or trying to, in the United States for going to war against Iran, and precious few Democrats are opposing it, at least at this point. We also had Gareth Porter, a favorite reporter of Maria Tomczyk, at the Interpress Services, reporting that the Bush offer of negotiations with Iran that was so publicized when Condoleezza Rice did it in June was intended to fail, that it was a specific strategy by the Bush administration to foreclose future diplomatic actions as being impractical and force the U.S. toward military action. And if you remember, I talked a couple weeks ago about the San Francisco Chronicle report that said the attacks on Lebanon by Israel were, from the United States standpoint, to move Hezbollah away from the Israeli border so as to preclude the chances of retaliation there when either the U.S. or Israel struck Iran. Well, now there's reports in the Jerusalem Post and other Israeli media that at a summit between Bush and Prime Minister Omer of Israel on May 23rd of this year, that Bush gave Omer the green light for Israel to attack Lebanon and to attack Syria. It was the Israelis who thought that Bush was out of his mind and that attacking Syria would have been not only impractical, but they lacked a credible pretext for doing it. The inevitable conclusion of this, at least in the Israeli press, is that Bush actually wants a broader regional war involving all of these different countries so as to create his and Condoleezza's view of a new Middle East. Very, very frightening.
All right, and that takes us to Israel, Palestine, and Lebanon.
Yeah, I'll just run through this very quickly. That Israeli military court has charged the Speaker of the Palestinian Authority, Aziz Dwaik, of belonging to a terrorist group, that is Hamas, the winner of the democratic elections in the Palestinian Authority earlier this year. We had also the IDF continuing its kidnapping of elected Hamas leaders this week, with the deputy prime minister, the education minister, and the parliamentary secretary. We have Amnesty International accusing Israel of war crimes in Lebanon for the deliberate targeting of civilians, a charge Israel has denied, of course. And then we have a UN report that Israel dropped cluster bombs, which are, by definition, somewhat illegal munition, and also tends to kill civilians 170 times in southern Lebanon at civilian sites. And of course, the State Department has said that they are investigating whether the cluster bombs by the Israelis, which of course were sold to Israel by the United States, whether that use violates U.S. law. And of course, the obvious question is, well, if the U.S. was selling them to Israel in the first place, what on earth did they think Israel was going to use them for? So don't expect a lot out of that State Department investigation.
And in fact, there was articles in the paper where they rushed those over in the early days of...
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
All right. Anything else?
Yeah, just briefly, if you're wondering where all these different wars against Muslims are leading us, a couple more interesting polls in recent weeks. A USA Today Gallup poll showing that nearly 40% of Americans support requiring all Muslims, including U.S. citizens, to carry a special ID, quote, as a means of preventing terrorism. And a Cornell University poll showing that 27% of Americans support requiring all Muslims, again including U.S. citizens, to register with the government. If that doesn't sound creepily like a certain country in Northern Europe in the 30s, I really don't know what would.
All right.
And we do wonder why, Muslims think that we're, around the world think that we're trying to wage a war against all Muslims. It's just, there's no explaining the logic of those people.
talking, as we do every week, with Jav Parrish, co-editor of Eat the State. And where do people find Eat the State?
Eat the State comes out every couple of weeks, except that we're putting a little extra time into the issue that's coming out next on September 14th for a couple of reasons. The main one being that it's our 10th anniversary issue. The other being that we wanted to take an extra week off. The current issue that's out this week has all of our September 19th primary endorsements in it, since we're doing it earlier, since people do vote by mail these days. And we'll start going through those next week on this program also, so people can hear that. And if you want to find Eat the State, it's available free at places where you get free publications, bookstores and cafes, etc. It's also available on the web, as you know, with the endorsements, etc., at www.eatthestate.org. I have to confess, I actually haven't checked to see if the current issue is up on the web yet, but if it's not now, it should be any day. It is out in print, so and it takes our volunteer webmaster usually a couple more days to put it up on the web. But and if you have questions, comments, tips, feedback, any of that kind of stuff, and I'm still looking for a job, give us a call. Our voicemail is area code 206-719-6947.